From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Carl Racine, the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, and joining us in studio now is Ralph Northam, the Governor of Virginia. Governor Northam, thank you so much for coming down to join us, coming up to join us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back with you and Tom.
Tom, an update on the coronavirus pandemic coming from Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, today issuing a statement that the state surpassed 1,200 COVID-19 hospitalizations. So what is he going to do?
Well, he's ordered that the hospitals in the state start up again their pandemic protocols. They're going to limit surgeries, non-essential surgeries. This is all due to the Omicron variant that is sweeping the nation and, as we're going to soon find out here, I believe, sweeping the metropolitan region.
And what is it like in Virginia, Governor Northam?
Well, unfortunately, Kojo, our numbers are going up. We reported close to 3,500 new cases today, 28 additional deaths. We've seen an uptick in our hospitalizations, especially those that are requiring ICU care. And, you know, the frustration here is, Kojo, that these are unavoidable. People need to get out there and roll up their sleeve and get a shot.
Why aren't they? I mean, I know I've heard the politics of it, but as we were talking just before the show, people have seen their own relatives die in horrible deaths in hospitals. They've seen them kids not being able to go to school. And then, but there's still some people who think, well, I don't want to be told that this is a public health emergency. I'm not going to do it. What is there? You're a doctor.
You know, Tom, I don't completely understand it. It certainly has been frustrating. I think some of it is messaging. It has become an us versus them, and it should be looked at as a, you know, I served in the United States Army, as you know, and I'm trained in chemical warfare. This is a biological war that we're fighting. It's not us versus them. We're fighting a virus, and the only way to get rid of that virus, you know, viruses are smart, and they mutate, and that's what we're seeing with COVID-19, and the only way to deal with this is for folks to be part of the solution. You know, we talk about patriotism, all these types of things, but it's not just for themselves. It's for those around them. It's for our Commonwealth of Virginia. It's for this country. So people need to roll up their sleeve and go get a shot.
You told Wavy, doing an interview with Wavy this week, I think it was, that, you know, if someone steps on a nail, they go and get a tetanus shot without having a second thought about it. This is a tetanus shot, nail to the heart.
It absolutely is. And it's just, you know, I had COVID, as you know, Tom, and I've still got some long-term symptoms from it, and I'm fortunate that's all that happened. But these individuals that end up in the ICU are so, so sick, and then obviously a number of them are dying. But, you know, we're averaging in Virginia right now 30 deaths a day. That's a lot of people when you think about it, and every one of those deaths is tragic. It affects their families, and I'm like you. It's frustrating. We've worked so hard, Tom and Kojo, to make sure that we have access, especially that it's done equitably for folks to go out there and get a shot. We've even taken shots to the people, but there's still a number of folks out there that have chosen not to. Fortunately, Virginia's done well. We have about 87% of our adults now that have had at least one shot. Close to 65% of Virginians are completely vaccinated. So compared to other states, we're doing well, but we can certainly do better.
One more question on this, if I could. Are you contemplating any additional actions? Governor Hogan has taken some action. I spoke to the mayor's office, Mayor Bowser's office. She is looking at this onslaught of the Omicron. Are you considering things that you might announce next week during the holiday season?
Well, we look at the options every day. They're on the table, and certainly we are in close communication with our hospitals, and right now they're doing okay. But some of the areas, Tom, especially in rural areas of Virginia, they are being overwhelmed and having to ship some patients to other hospitals. So you mentioned elective surgeries that had been postponed. postpone. We haven't chose to do that yet, but we're sticking really to, you know, what we've been saying all along. Go out there and get a shot when you're in close proximity to other folks. Wear a mask. Keep your distancing. And these are the things that will work if people will just follow those guidelines.
Before we get to Virginia specifically, something that affects all the region, Tom Sherwood, the Metro Safety Commission says that Metro can return to the 7,000 series trains which were taken out of service. How significant is that?
Well, it's really significant. Of course, COVID has walloped the Metro system in terms of ridership on the rail system. And then in October, there was a derailment, and it turned out horribly that 7,000 series cars, which make up 60% of the rail service in Metro, had a faulty wheelbase alignment or something, and so they were all taken out, and there was limited service available. Now there's a plan put together by Metro to bring these cars back. It will be over many weeks. It won't just be next week or first of the year to put these cars back in service. These cars, these 7,000 series cars, will be inspected every 7 days. The previous policy was to inspect them every 90 days.
And I suspect a lot of people who have, over the past year or so during this pandemic and Metro's problems, taken to commuting by car will, I guess, Governor Northam, hopefully return to Metro.
We certainly hope so. And as you probably remember, Virginia was first in line to support Metro. Certainly Maryland and D.C., they have been very cooperative as well. You know, we've done a lot of other work here in Northern Virginia with rail, opening up the Long Bridge. We've worked with CSX and Norfolk Southern, the VRE system. And, you know, we have all along felt, Kojo, that we can't pave our way out of this congestion. And certainly rail and transit needs to be encouraged. And we've invested a significant amount of resources in that mode of transportation. And like you said, we hope people, as COVID-19 hopefully is in the rearview mirror, will get back and use our rail and transit.
Northern Virginia is the economic engine of much of the state. The Silver Line, it's not still not. I cannot take the Silver Line to Dulles yet. Will we be getting there soon?
I certainly hope so. It's certainly been a priority.
Governor Northam, today the time capsule that was placed in the pedestal of the Robert E. Lee statue in Richmond may have been discovered. This capsule was first put there in 1887. Can you remind us about that history and when you might be able to confirm if what workers found is, in fact, the capsule?
Well, Kojo, thank you for that question. And so the Lee statue was put up in the late 1800s, long after the Civil War had been fought, to be specific. And there are a number of other monuments, statues that were there to glorify the lost cause that have come down in Richmond. And we are really excited about that. And to your point, it was said, a lot of the museum leaders, historians, said that there was a time capsule under that statue. And we didn't find it initially, but as we have started removing the pedestal about a week ago, we found what we think is the time capsule this morning. It will be carefully removed, which will take several hours, perhaps another day, and then be taken to the Department of Historic Resources, and it will be dealt with properly. But I think everybody's very curious, enthusiastic about seeing what was in that particular time capsule.
You had a role in the having the statue taken down. I've stood there in Monument Circle. I have a picture of myself with that statue. It was defaced by protesters. The statue itself is gone. The base is now going to be taken away. What's going to happen to that? Some people thought that ought to be preserved as a transition from that statue, but what's going to happen to the base?
Well, it's a great question, and we have several very good and reputable museums in Richmond, and we have made an agreement with them, working with the city of Richmond, that the statues and the material from the pedestals will be in the property of these museums, and then they will kind of figure out as we move forward how to best preserve them. And we certainly, Tom, we don't want to forget about our history. I think it's important to say, you know, we need to know where we've been in order to see where we're going. But we are a much more inclusive state, a much more welcoming state. We embrace diversity in Virginia, and we just don't need statues that are there to glorify the Confederacy and the lost cause. And so I think we're certainly in a much better place in Virginia right now than we were 4 years ago.
I don't know, Kojo, if you said this in the introduction. The governor's here. He's at the end of a four-year term. In Virginia, you can't run for a second term, so he's out in a couple of weeks.
You have released, however, your two-year budget proposal, where it looks like you're trying to put Virginia's $2.6 billion surplus to use. What are you focusing on?
We're investing it back into the people. They're actually going to get a tax rebate. Those filing singly will get $250. Those filing jointly, $500. We're also, Kojo, something I ran on in 2017 was to eliminate the grocery tax. As we know, it's a very regressive tax. It was put in place back in 1966, so it's time for that to go. So we're also bringing up our earned income tax credit, which will help workers of lower income. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to approach tax cuts, but we want to do it the right way and make sure that as we move forward, it really helps those that need it the most in Virginia.
Well, Governor-elect Youngkin campaigned on eliminating the grocery tax, and you are now proposing it. But he also says that the massive surplus shows that Virginians are overtaxed and the money should go back to them. What's your response to that?
Well, the massive surplus shows that we've had good fiscal stewardship over the past 4 years. And no, there haven't been any changes, Kojo, in our tax code for years. So this isn't about overtaxing. It's about our economy, despite COVID-19, doing extremely well. A surplus, record surplus of $2.6 billion. So, you know, we go through cycles. Back in 2008, we were cutting our budget literally into the bone. So we need to be very careful and prudent moving forward. Obviously, there can be some adjustments in our tax code, but we need to save for that rainy day also.
Well, part of the money, the reason you have so much money is because of the federal move that many Republicans opposed in Congress to send, I think, $6 or $7 billion to the state of Virginia and other jurisdictions and local governments. In fact, virtually every state and local government is flush with money now, and nobody elected office will say that. They won't use the word flush. But you are spending the money, but some of it is one-time money, and it won't be there. So that's where you have to be careful how you spend it.
You're exactly right, Tom. And so a significant amount of it is one time, but also our revenue that's ongoing is doing exceptionally well.
See, he didn't say the word flush.
To the tune of billions of dollars. So, I mean, doing things like that we've been talking about for years, like investing in education, making sure that our teachers receive a well-deserved raise, supporting law enforcement, putting more money into structure of our schools. So a lot of good things are being done with this investment. And, you know, one of the reasons I got into politics, Tom, I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay. It was literally our backyard, and we're putting record amounts, over $1 billion, to really restore the health of the Bay, and that's something that I've been committed to doing.
Republicans are claiming that you basically stole the idea of Glenn Youngkin had of getting rid of the state portion of the grocery tax. Now, we all know, for those who've lived long enough, that, you know, getting rid of the grocery tax has been a Democratic idea since the 70s. Henry Howell, look him up. I'm not going to explain who that was, but he wanted to get rid of it back then. I think Mark Warner did. But now it's being done. But most states, you'll only be like 5 or 6 states have gotten rid of the grocery tax. It's a lot of money.
It is. And Mark Warner, to your point, he lowered the grocery tax. But the reason why we're able to do this, Tom, is because we have the revenue now. Like I said, I ran on it in 2017, but, you know, we had COVID. We just didn't have the resources that we needed. But now we can do it, and I'm keeping my promise on a commitment that I made.
Here's Barbara in Arlington, Virginia. Barbara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you very much. Hello, Governor.
Hello, Barbara.
I am an independent educator, and I have been for 25 years. I've discovered why English works the way it does, why people think the way they do in English. And I have worked with Virginia Commonwealth University. I have an ongoing contract with a very important hospital in New York to train medical
students. You have established your credentials, Barbara, but do you have a question?
I do.
Oh, go ahead, please, and ask it.
Why does the Virginia Employment Commission malign someone in my position? I have waited for 21 months. I've spent all my savings. I had 15 months of savings set aside.
You've been waiting for 21 months for what?
The federal pandemic unemployment assistance to help me.
And you have not gotten it?
Not 1 cent.
And Governor Northam, are there others like Barbara who have been complaining about not getting that compensation?
Kojo, during COVID-19, we've had over 1.7 million Virginians apply for unemployment, and for the most part, and I think especially compared to other states, we have done well, but there are certainly people out there that we need to continue to help. So I would encourage Barbara to call our constituent services. We'll put you in touch with the people that you need to and do everything that we can to get your benefits to you, Barbara. So sorry you've been delayed.
Barbara, thank you very much for your call, and good luck to you.
Governor, you made your big announcement on the budget just yesterday. You did a nonpartisan thing. You invited Governor-elect Glenn Youngkin to come join you at the announcement of it. You've also had him at the governor's mansion where he'll be living. You'll be moving out to a trailer or something, I guess. But a lot of people don't know Glenn Youngkin. He came out of the right field into politics. People don't know him. Some of the conservatives in Virginia are already taking little pot shots at him that he may not be as Trumpish as they would want him to be on issues like abortion. What can you tell us about Glenn Youngkin and your one-to-one interaction with
him? How has it been working with him on this transition? Are you two getting along?
Absolutely, Kojo. And I've had a couple very good meetings with him. I've had the opportunity to meet his wife. His wife and my wife are actually from similar areas in Texas. So they've had a very good start to their relationship. He's a listener. He's taking notes. I think, learning about how things work in Richmond. And what I would say, I think he's prepared to lead Virginia. And what an opportunity that he has. I mean, when I turn over the keys on January the 15th, Virginia has never been in this kind of shape in a lot of ways, but especially with our economy. So he has a wonderful opportunity. He also has a responsibility. A lot of what we've delivered on over the last 4 years has been the result of listening, learning, and then taking action. So good things have happened in Virginia. We're much more progressive. We're embracing diversity, and I think he'll be able to continue to lead Virginia, especially if he continues to work on the progress that we've made.
I was thinking more of your personal interaction, what he's like. He's very press shy. He's only had one press conference, I think, since he got elected. But just personally, can you comment on him in a nice, pleasant, polite Southern way that you're going to?
No, he came over to the mansion and we had a nice lunch, and he seemed like a very personable person. And again, it's a big responsibility, Tom, leading.
And he recognizes that?
I suspect he does. If he doesn't, once he sits in that chair behind the desk on Monday morning, he'll figure out what's going on.
Kathleen in Alexandria said there are reports that your successor asked members of his transition team to sign non-disclosure agreements. If they are acting on behalf of the residents of the Commonwealth of Virginia, transparency, says Kathleen, is in order.
I agree with her, and I don't, again, that what he does is his business, but he's in his transition now, and January the 15th is soon upon us, so hopefully he'll be ready to serve.
Here's Andy in Virginia. Andy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Governor. I work in the Army Installations, Energy, and Environment at the Pentagon as a civilian, and I had a suggestion, and I don't know if you guys have looked into it, but given that COVID spread mostly through indoor transmission, and that good ventilation is essential for reducing the incidence of the virus, I thought perhaps that the Army National Guard could contract with the Corps of Engineers to design some very simple outdoor structures that are well ventilated, that could be heated or have decent insulation, and that we could have the Guard assist counties set up outdoor dining facilities to help restaurants. Some restaurants have done this on their own, but you know, they're all kind of on their own. Some of them, you know, a lot of them don't know anything about indoor air quality. You know, if they had standardized designs with simple materials they could go get at Lowe's or Home Depot or whatever, you know, we could really, you know, help people dine or enjoy socialization, you know, outdoors in a safer manner. And it wouldn't be politicized about masks and stuff like that. I just wanted to get your suggestion, thoughts on that, sir.
Andy, I appreciate your call and your ideas. And certainly the more we can be outdoors, the more we can be in well-ventilated rooms, the better. I will tell you that the National Guard, which I oversee, has been very helpful during COVID. I mean, they helped with our testing. They've helped with our vaccines. I will say, though, that they are being stretched fairly thin. I've got over 2,000 of our National Guardsmen mobilized right now around the world. And the last thing I would say, they would have more time on their hands if we didn't have occurrences like the insurrection that occurred on January the 6th. I had to deploy about 4,000 of our National Guardsmen to bring order back to our national capital, and everybody should find that as a disgrace. So, but they've done a great job, and they will continue to, and I will actually look at your idea, but the more we can be outside, the more ventilation we have, certainly the better with COVID-19 numbers rising.
In another email, Kathleen from Alexandria says, states with mask mandates have a lower death rate from COVID than those without. Please explain why, as a medical doctor, you did not impose a statewide mask mandate for indoor settings.
Well, Kathleen, as you know, we have a mask mandate in our schools, and I agree with you. The more that we can wear masks indoors, the better. It's actually in our code. It's in our law of Virginia that we will follow the CDC guidelines. So we certainly want to keep our children as safe and healthy as possible. We know that the best place for them is back in the classroom. As far as out in the public in other buildings, Kathleen, I agree with you, but it is very, very difficult to enforce. And so we have strongly encouraged it. But to make it a mandate it comes with all kinds of complications. So, but certainly encourage folks to wear masks when they're indoors.
She mentioned that you are a medical doctor. Is this a practice you intend to resume after leaving office?
I'm a pediatric neurologist. I practiced for about 25 years before coming to the governor's mansion. And so my plans, Kojo, I started a practice back in Norfolk back in the late 90s. So inauguration is on January the 15th. I'm going to take Sunday off, and then Monday morning on the 17th, I plan to be in my office seeing patients.
Good luck to that first patient. Let me ask you, we've got to ask this. You started your career in the governor's office with the blackface incident. We won't go through all the details, but people remember it well enough. You pivoted and went around the state and said that you would make racial justice and racial equity sensitivity part of your administration. You have done that. Is there anything in particular that you think stands out among all the things you did in terms of law enforcement changes and different things that the legislature's done? What did you personally learn from that pivoting of your political career?
No, it's a great question. And, you know, we knew there were a number of inequities when I took office, and certainly the yearbook incident put those into much stronger focus, especially for me. I have listened to a lot of folks. I've learned a lot. As I say, the more I know, the more I can do. And I'm glad that Virginians stuck with me. And I really think that, Tom, that Virginia is a more diverse, more open, inclusive state because of everything that has happened. And I'm proud of the work we've done. But we still have a lot of work to do, whether it be access to education, access to health care, business opportunities, et cetera. So we need to make sure that we keep Virginia a welcoming and inclusive state.
We only have about 40 seconds left, and Janice online wants to ask a question. We don't have enough time to put Janice online, so I'll ask the question. Will you support reciprocity between Virginia and D.C. to support Vision Zero? There's no reciprocity in terms of the tickets and boots that people from Virginia get here. And Mayor Bowser apparently has not asked you at this point for reciprocity. Is that something that you would be willing to give?
I would certainly be willing to discuss it. As you know, Kojo, my time is limited. I've only got about 20 days left.
But you don't speed when you're leaving town, because you'll get a ticket and you won't have to pay it because there's no reciprocity.
I will say that I have had a great relationship with Mayor Bowser, and she's a tremendous leader.
Ralph
and
Northam,
look forward to continuing that.
Is the governor of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thanks
for
having me.
First patient the day after you leave office will be Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Carl Racine. He is the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Carl Racine, thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Kojo. Great to be with you.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to the Attorney General, no more reversible lanes coming to Connecticut Avenue, Northwest Washington.
Yes, a big change is coming. Connecticut Avenue is a major thoroughfare for commuters going out into Montgomery County. But the mayor, after long discussions by her Department of Transportation, going to take away a lot of the parking. They're going to put two-way bike lanes on the streets. There's going to be those that horrible thing in the morning, in the afternoon, where the lanes are one way in the morning and one way going out in the
right
afternoon.
Outside our offices.
Nightmare.
Here, and we witnessed a lot of accidents.
1,500 wrecks in the last 3 years. They're going to do this, but there's some concern that some of the businesses, small businesses, depend on street parking, won't have that. And then whether or not the enforcement will be done by police on the bike lanes, there's a lot going on with what's going to happen on Connecticut Avenue, where the major thoroughfares through the district.
And there's a big deal in the district now of looking at the safety of children, who all of a sudden seem to be getting hit by cars all the time, especially in districts where there are schools.
Yeah, we all complained about the craziness that people are driving around town and around the schools. 40 people have been struck and killed in the city, some of them children. Ward 4 Councilmember Janice Lewis-George and Ward 1 Councilmember Brianne Nadeau have proposed legislation, things that will do like raise crosswalks, speed bumps, cameras, all kinds of things to slow people down. If people aren't going to do it so they don't kill someone, we have to change the infrastructure in our intersection, particularly around schools, so that the drivers won't be killing our children.
General Racine, is that something you would favor?
Absolutely. And Tom, I have to congratulate you and praise you, honestly, for your focus on this issue. And I think it deserves so much attention. You know, let me give you some facts here. D.C. had 37 traffic fatalities last year, up from 27 in 2019, and the highest number of fatalities in the year since 2008. This year, we hit a 14-year high of 40 fatality deaths. Even more troubling, we're seeing a concentration of these fatalities east of Rock Creek Park. Also, there's some really troubling clusters that we all know about along Southern Avenue near Fort DuPont and three further south in Congress Heights. The number of people killed in traffic incidents has increased year over year in five of the last 6 years since Vision Zero was launched. The traffic death count has not fallen below 26, which was the toll before Vision Zero in 2014. Putting Vision Zero's aspirations to eliminate traffic deaths in 2024 much further from reach. This is an issue that needs council oversight. And thank you to Council Member Nadeau and the other council members, Janice Lewis-George, who are on top of this. This is definitely a problem of drivers being reckless, but my God, the government has to act. And if you know that Vision Zero is not working, why don't you just put that on pause? Because all it is the Washington Post editorial board said yesterday, is a slogan that is not actually being implemented.
Well, in there I heard what can be considered a criticism of the current regime in the District of Columbia. So I'm going to jump right to politics. You've decided not to run for another term as Attorney General. Why is that, and why aren't you running for mayor?
It's the hardest decision I've ever made in my life because I care so deeply about the city that raised me. I also, frankly, believe that I'm well-suited to lead and manage. Look at the Office of Attorney General, the best Office of Attorney General in the United States. Don't ask me, talk to my peers. So Tom, I gotta tell you, excuse me, Kojo, every morning
you can talk to
I wake
me.
Up. Oh, okay. I know I'm going to. Every morning, I praised you first before the fire. Every morning, I wake up and honestly reflect on that because I obviously have endorsed someone else, Robert White, because I think a change is dramatically necessary.
Okay. Well, good. Since Kojo brought up politics, why have you still not closed your own official campaign for Attorney General? I looked at it last night and still in the books. You're still technically an official candidate for reelection. Are you going to close that account?
I'm going to close the account before the time that it's necessary to close. And in the interest of completeness, Tom, I know you're always interested in being totally complete. You, of course, know that I have not raised a dollar.
Right.
Because I've not asked anyone for a dollar.
And here's...
So my intention to not run is manifested by my not asking for money, though every single morning, especially when I watch the news about the Department of Forensic Services, right? And the calamity of leadership that has led to a recommendation from an independent body that the Department of Forensic Services investigations that were relied on for evidence since 2014 in all criminal cases be reviewed, that's a really big problem. Core important aspects of our government are completely not being led well.
Now let me get to the finish of the politics before we get back to public policy, because I have, this has been said to me, it may be ridiculous, it may be true, I have been told by some people that you're not closing your attorney general campaign because if Robert White happens to falter in the June 28th primary, you will run as an independent for mayor in November. That would be maybe, no, absolutely not. What's the answer?
Let me just tell you the truth on that.
I am the independent.
That's all you get from me, Tom. Sometimes it's faster than you like, but it's coming.
Okay.
I love being the independent attorney general. I am a Democrat. I have never thought for one conscious moment about running as an independent against the Democratic nominee. Would I give it some thought now that you put that in my brain? Maybe.
Okay. Now, I have one more political question. You endorsed in the New York governor's race, and your candidate
has
since withdrawn, but that's a great thing. You've endorsed in the mayor. You mentioned Robert White. You've endorsed even, I think, this week in the Ward 5 race. Now, you have not yet.
Zachary Parker.
Ward 5. I'm not doing the promotion. You may do that.
Well, there are four other Democrats in that race. Vincent Dorrance, Faith Gibson.
Right.
Gibson Hubbard, Gordon Fletcher, and Harry Thomas.
That's why I didn't want to mention, because you have to name all of them.
I did. But
when are you going to endorse in the attorney general race? You've got Brian Swab, who has the job similar to you had at Venable as a partner in charge. There's Bruce Biva, who is a...
Let me correct you there. Brian is the partner in charge of the D.C. office.
Yes.
I was the managing partner of the entire law firm, over 600 lawyers, the first African-American managing partner of a top 100 firm.
Got it. And Kenyon McDuffie, the council member who's running for attorney.
So here's what I think about that.
Are you going to endorse?
I will endorse. Tom, you know me, and I'm going to be, you can accuse me fairly of being way too engaged in D.C. politics. My mother, who is my heart and soul, told me, Carl, if you ever have the opportunity to influence good, do it until your dying breath. And that's what I'm going to do. And I will no doubt endorse the best candidate for attorney general. I think there may not be other people getting into the race, Tom. As to Brian, he's an excellent lawyer. Kenyon, you know, is a really, really decent human being. There's no doubt about that. He assisted the independent office of attorney general in surviving when Mayor Bowser wanted to take that away. I am forever indebted to that. I don't know Mr. Spiva. I certainly don't know Ryan Jones. And I'm looking, frankly, and talking to other people to see whether they might be interested in getting in the race.
That's the news of the day.
On to Perry in Brightwood. Perry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Hello, Attorney General Racine and Tom. Kojo, thank you. My question to you, you've been lauded for your aggressive prosecution of slumlords like Vista Ridge and Marbury and Forest Ridge. Your office, Social Justice Arm in particular, has been made well aware of the Southeast D.C. development that's been cited by DCRA. Over 200 times.
What's it called?
It's called Woodbury.
Thank you.
Departments. And so with you going after New Bethel, the black church over there, the ownership of Woodbury Village is not black. Why are you not, or why have you not sought to prosecute after the tenants had come to your office over an October ago where they didn't have heat, and they don't have heat this October come?
So Perry, I got the implication of your question, but I want to be clear. Are you suggesting that the Attorney General is going after a black owner as a slumlord while avoiding going after a white owner as a slumlord? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's one suggestion.
Okay, well, let me have Carl Racine respond.
So here's the deal, Mr. Perry, and I respect the question. And look, the Office of Attorney General, and certainly the Attorney General, is not perfect. We do sin. We sometimes make professional mistakes. But here's the deal. We represent vulnerable tenants when they are being taken advantage of without regard to whether they are black, white, AAPI, or anything else. That's why we won a case on Connecticut and Van Ness Street, Van Ness Apartments, as a result of illegal concessions. They were all, a lot of them, white tenants. We don't care who the tenant is, what the color is, and we certainly don't care who the landlord, management company, or developer is. The suggestion is outrageous. Let me talk about New Bethel, because they have a campaign led by a lot of wealthy developers, does that sound familiar, who are claiming that the Office of Attorney General is responsible for displacing black people from Washington, D.C. How outrageous does that sound? Let me assure you that we follow the law. There's a legal process. Sometimes we win through that process. Very rarely we lose. A court decides this. The Office of Attorney General believes what Martin Luther King believes, that everyone should be treated fairly, equally, without regard to race. Mr. Perry.
Thank you very much for your call. You announced this week a lawsuit against two far-right extremist groups for the role they played in the January 6th insurrection, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. What exactly are you alleging?
So we're alleging what everyone saw live and or on video, that an insurrectionist vigilante mob led by two known hate organizations, that's the Oath Keepers, and that, of course, is the Proud Boys, and 30-plus other individuals organized, planned, conspired, and participated in a violent attempt to take our country's freedom away. That's why we're suing. In addition, give Chief Conte credit, because what, and you know, for that matter, former Chief Newsom also deserves credit, because they had Metropolitan Police Department officials ready to go when they could go to repel the attack. And guess what happened to our men and women in blue? They were beaten by flagpoles, shocked and tasered like Officer Michael Fanone, and they defended our liberty. We're suing for recompense and restitution, to hold these people accountable, to seek justice. Recompense, accountability, seeking justice are American values. That's why we're suing.
Well, an attorney representing two of the defendants said that this lawsuit targets the wrong people, saying that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers were not the ones assaulting the police. How would you respond?
I would say that President Trump said that as well. He called them, he said Antifa was actually the ones who, you know, had Trump outfits on, Trump flags, Trump hats, Confederate flags, that the Antifa are the people that had the wooden gallows erected, that they wanted to hang Mike Pence. I'm asking you to be honest and say, that's ridiculous. Why did President Trump call these people patriots? He said, he can't have it both ways. They're not Antifa when you call them patriots. These were Trump supporters, hate groups dedicated to take away our freedoms.
Mr. Attorney General, the U.S. attorney here is pursuing the criminal cases. I think there's more than 700 now defendants looking into the riot insurrection on Capitol Hill. I think your civil suit, I think it's called a civil suit, right?
That's right.
Will depend somewhat on the evidence that the U.S. attorney gathers. What will you do in terms of investigating your office will do to investigate to prepare the case against these Proud Boys and Oath Keepers? And will this case last longer than your time in office, which will end in early 2023?
Oh, those are great questions. Let me just say, first of all, Matt Graves is the new U.S. attorney. He's an exceptional lawyer and a very, very decent person, lived in D.C. for 20 years. We've already had occasion to work together, and I welcome him to the District of Columbia. I'm very happy that he's the U.S. attorney. Now, as to your question about possible coordination or overlap, you're right, Tom. Our case is civil. The Department of Justice case is criminal, and they're going after individuals. So those are two different cases. Moreover, if you really study the DOJ cases, oftentimes they're resulting in guilty pleas for things like trespassing. I'm not going to question the U.S. attorney. I get why you do guilty pleas, but we're not civilly prosecuting anybody for trespassing. We're prosecuting them for trying to take away our freedom and hurting our police officers. Different cases, different systems. And yes, I'm going to work hard as heck to advance this lawsuit until I'm no longer the attorney general.
Your office is going to expand what it does for housing affordability in the district. How are you changing How are you changing your approach?
So this is really important, and I think it's also a hard story to report, and so I don't think it's been well reported. The Office of Attorney General has two responsibilities, the independent Attorney General. One is to represent the agencies of the District of Columbia, provide the council advice. It has its own general counsel, as well as to provide advice to the mayor. She has her own general counsel and the mayor's office of legal counsel. The second part, which is co-equal mandatory, is that we have to use the law in the public interest. I have interpreted that to mean, and you get a chance to get another AG to interpret it differently. I hope they don't interpret it differently. I interpret public interest to mean focus on our most vulnerable residents. In the area of zoning, to be honest, the Office of Attorney General has been locked in having to defend, honestly, the development arm of this city. I think the development arm of this city has acted intentionally with great purpose, and we see the result. The highest level of displacement of anywhere else in the United States of America. Now the Office of Attorney General is free, free at last, to act independently. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to work as hard as we can for the next 13 months to ensure that zoning laws and other actions actually don't hurt longtime DC residents and vulnerable people. And I look forward to crossing swords with the development arm of the government so that a court can decide what's fair and what's not.
A couple of follow-ups, because you did point out that a large part of the role that you have is providing legal guidance for agencies like DC Zoning and Commission. Do you think that your office advocating for affordable housing could impair your ability to do that? Because we got this message on Twitter who says, could you please ask Attorney General Racine if he has received any indications of support on, or I guess from the Zoning Commission, for your recent affordable housing proposals?
The Zoning Commission obviously is nervous about what we're doing because for the last 20 plus years, and I like Anthony Hood on a personal level, for the last 20 plus years, they've been going at it with the result that there's been more displacement of DC residents, particularly black and brown, than any other jurisdiction in the country. So yes, I'm sure they're a little concerned because we see things differently. Our public interest mandate is to stand up for vulnerable residents, not escort them out of town.
Well, I'm not going to get into the Department of Corrections things. We had that discussion in early November. Let me ask you a larger question. The OxyContin settlement, the Purdue Pharma
huge
thing, a federal judge in New York Southern District said this week that he threw out the settlement, the billions of dollars in settlement, saying the Sackler family unfairly was shielded from civil lawsuits. The Sackler family has a big footprint here in the District of Columbia with the Smithsonian. Where are you on wanting to have the Sackler family be more culpable or responsible for OxyContin? Is your office doing anything in this field?
We're a major player, Tom. We don't just go in the back of the line. We go up front. And so 9 jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, objected to the Sackler family attempt to settle a case and to essentially give them amnesty. And so we just won a case before a judge, federal judge in New York, that said that settlement that absolves the Sacklers of liability is no good because it cannot absolve them of liability.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
So 9 states, including the District of Columbia, are coming after the Sacklers.
There's another national, if I have time to mention it, the Governor Newsom, Gavin Newsom in California, says if Texas can pass a law that says citizens can sue people who try to have abortions after 6 weeks, then he will get the legislature to pass a law that allows citizens to sue gun manufacturers who kill people. Do you support what Governor Newsom is trying to do?
I certainly support the objective. I think it's more complicated than his explanation, to be honest. And that's because there is a federal statute. As you know, the NRA are the best lobbyists. They know how to give the money and where to give the money and where to get the results, and they get them. And so there's a statute that actually precludes jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, arguably, from suing gun manufacturers. That's the thing that needs to be taken out.
But citizens now, Tom, could sue.
You know, Tom, you're making a really, really good point. I need to look at that a little bit more carefully because, again, the NRA is so dastardly and devilishly good that they may have, with their statute, precluded even that. I will take a look at that, and I'm happy to report to you what I find.
Thank you.
Hey, Tom, can I talk about something else?
Yes, we only have about a minute left, so please do.
Kojo is the host.
Okay, the District of Columbia should really know that earlier this week, Tuesday night, late night, of course, the administration released a report concerning the Department of Forensic Services. DFS, as it's known, evaluates all the evidence, DNA, guns, bullets, all that stuff. And guess what the report said? The report said that the DFS has been extremely poorly led to a point where its results are so questionable that it urges all the prosecutors, that's OAG and the U.S. Attorney's Office, to actually review every conviction over the last 7 years. This is shocking. And guess what? The administration told you, don't believe the hype. They blame the U.S. Attorney's Office and OAG for this. It's not us. Again, we need an administration that actually competently manages important agencies like the Department of Forensic Services.
I'm afraid we're just about out of time, except for this from Peter, who says he's a member of Ward 3 Democrats in an email. Could you ask Mr. Racine what he plans to do, if anything, to further cause statehood, further the cause of D.C. statehood? And then Amy said, these past few years, being a D.C. resident living without congressional representation, have been particularly challenging. A bright spot has been Carl Racine, whose tireless leadership and actions to protect our democracy have been an inspiration.
What are you going to do? Yeah, and also, what are you going to do when you're out of office next year?
You know, Tom, I'm going to be blamed for being way too active in D.C. matters.
I get that impression.
I ain't going nowhere.
Carl Racine, you got to go someplace right now because we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bring the hammer down.
We will not have a show next week on December 24th, but I hope you'll join us on December 31st for our special Year in Review show. We'll look back at the major political events of 2021 and look at 2022. Thank you all for listening. Stay safe. Happy holidays. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Politics Hour with Kodwo Nnamdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobstorff. Today's engineer was Kenny Pierog, and our broadcast engineer is Adrian Danhauser. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.